the different numbers like?
Pardon? Oh, one of the members asked why the, I think it's honorable person, why the emission limits, even if, though it's SO2, are different for different units that were granted.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members and colleagues. To start with my explanation, remember different units have got different purposes and then they use different raw materials. So depending on what is the purpose of the unit, you'll obviously, and the raw material and what you're trying to achieve, you'll obviously produce different pollutants. I will just give an example. Sometimes if you have a combustion installation, for example, although you can use sulfur in combustion installation, you'll form more SO2 if it's an oxidative process. Then if it's a reducing process, you're more likely to form H2S but less SO2. And based on that, hence you're going to have a different standard. I can also give an example of a power generation plant. Sometimes if you have a solid fuel combustion, like when you're using coal and biomass, you expect to have more PM coming out of your boiler. But if your boiler is a gas boiler, for example, which is the cleanest one, you expect to have different PM. Hence, we have different limits. For solid ones, we normally have around 100 milligram per normal meter cubed, and then for gas one, we have like 10, which is much, much lower.
Okay. All right, any more responses?
Thanks, Chair. I know there was a question on compliance and enforcement at the local authority, but I'm not sure the members here now. Must I still respond to it?
Yeah.
Okay. I think the question was around the local authority and the capacity that they have and how we work, how we make decisions where we as national enforcement can get involved. So I think basically since 2007, we've been prioritizing certain sectors. So we started with the ferroalloy iron and steel industry, and we've basically moved through those different facilities in terms of doing compliance and enforcement, but we do it as a team. So it's ourselves as national environmental inspectors, provincial and local authority, and I think what we have done is we've used those opportunities to really build the capacity within the province and within the local level. So on that project, on the refinery project, as well as on the there's been a couple of other hazardous waste, et cetera, where we do these joint multi-skilled inspections. And then what generally happens is we move into enforcement, normally through administrative action. And I think the question was, how do we then take that action, because it is actually a local authority, particularly in relation to non-compliances to the AELs. So what would generally happen is because province and national have a concurrent competency around pollution control and environment, we can also issue notices and do investigations around the air pollution issues, even though the main mandate is supposed to be with the local authority. So there has been, we have got council opinion to say that we can step in and do compliance and enforcement around that, but obviously air pollution is not supposed to be our main competence, and therefore we would only do that with regard to certain sectors where we've prioritized it. I think the other thing to be aware of is that, as I said, we are trying to build up capacity at local authority level. So at the moment, the number's even higher than on that slide I showed you. We've got 322 local authority EMIs, and there's another 124 that have been trained that are waiting for designation. And the protocols that the provincial authorities sign with the local authorities said that they would prioritize air quality compliance and enforcement. So we've also got various arrangements with the technical universities, where they're also building in the EMI training into the EHP, which is the environmental health practitioner training. So when EHPs come out of that, they're able to become designated EMIs already. So there's various mechanisms where we're really trying to build up that capacity. And I think also just to note, in 18-19, we've just come out of our strategic planning, where we're going to really look at capacitating for air quality-related issues within the local authorities and working more strategically with them. Because as Thule said, we build up that capacity and then those people leave. So looking at how we can be more sustainable about building that capacity in the local authorities.
Okay, thank you. The question was not answered about the extension up to 2030.
So it was the PowerPoint. It's 2015 to 31 March 2020. So it starts with the 2015-31.
It's not 2025.
2020 or 2025. So for example,
there's not 2025.
The SO2 for Kenda says 2025, but the postponement itself starts from 2020 to 2025. So there's no, it is not legally possible to grant a postponement beyond a 5-year period. So they had applied beginning of 2010 and we declined that part. We granted between 2020 and 2025. So there's no 2030. I saw on, I think the way the PowerPoint columns are, it says 2015 then dash 31, but that 31, the March is below. It's 31 March 2020.
Okay. All right. Can we then move, if there's no further questions, can we move to the next presentation, which will be done by Center for Environmental Rights.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and members, everyone else. I'm Robin Hugo, the Center for Environmental Rights, and I'll be co-presenting with Professor Eugene Kencross. I'm sure we are quite short of time, so I will try to be fairly speedy. So, for instance, what you also have, you've got a sort of a script of my presentation, so the detail is there. The Life After Coal campaign, you can see who the members are. We together with the Groundwork and Earth Life Africa, Johannesburg. Really, the campaign, together with partners and clients with whom we work, including the High Fault Environmental Justice Network and the Vaal Environmental Justice Alliance, we've been active in our attempts to ensure implementation, enforcement of, and compliance with the MES, especially in the context of the urgent need to improve air quality in the priority areas in particular. I think we all know which those are. There's three of them. Vaal Triangle, which was declared in 2006, then the Highveld Priority Area and the Waterberg. And our particular concern is about the postponements of MES compliance that were granted to a number of Eskom coal-fired power stations, all of which are in one of the three priority areas, the majority in the Highveld, as well as to Sasol, whose operations are also in the priority areas. These are the country's two biggest polluters. We're going to focus, though, on Eskom, because the operations of Sasol, Sasolburg, Natref, and Synfuels are all in the Highveld and Vaal Triangle priority areas. Eskom and Sasol. What we seek is the full implementation and compliance with the MES, and we strongly object to any postponement applications which don't meet the requirements that are set out in the list of activities. Tuli mentioned some of those, but they should also be read together with the requirements in the framework for air quality management. So, among other things, before you can apply for a postponement, ambient air quality standards have to be in compliance and will remain in compliance even if the postponement is granted, and you have to be able to demonstrate that the current and proposed air emissions of your facility are not causing and will not cause any adverse impacts on the surrounding environment. So despite Eskom and Sasol's detailed participation in this extensive, collaborative, multi-stakeholder process in which the MES was set, which took about 5 years, they both initially applied to be completely exempt from the MES. The minister rightly rejected that application as being legally impermissible. And what happened then was that they both applied for wide-ranging postponements, and we objected to those vigorously and in detail. So Eskom asked for 14 of its 15 coal-fired power stations to postpone compliance with the MES. And we dispute that they should have received those extensive postponements that were granted, not only because of the devastating health impacts that we set out in the objections to the applications, but because the applications didn't actually comply with the requirements of the legislative framework. So those include the reasons that I've just set out above, that the ambient air quality standards were not in compliance and the negative impact that the emissions would have on the environment. Prof. Cairncross is going to give us some more detail about why ESCOM's modeling was of its emissions was misleading and inaccurate. So whilst these wide-ranging postponement applications were pending, SAFL then sued the Minister and the National Air Quality Officer. And what they wanted to do was set aside the MES while the postponement decisions, as I say, were still pending. The DEA opposed this application, defending the MES, and the National Air Quality Officer filed a very strongly worded answering affidavit, accusing SAFL of using tactics and misdirection to hide their delay in bringing the review and the associated delay in investing in emission abatement technology towards compliance with the MES to combat pollution. She said what SAFL actually wanted was a judicial license to continue with the air pollution unabated over the next few years. When the postponement application outcomes were then announced in February 2015 and were largely granted, SAFL withdrew its litigation. The minister indicated when she was giving the outcomes of the postponements that they were intended to provide an opportunity for industry to take the necessary action and retrofit their plants to enable them to comply with the standards in the near future. She also commented that applicants all had to submit so-called compliance roadmaps, and these would set out when they envisaged to have completed their various tasks about investments that were required to ensure compliance with the MES. She says, as such, the decisions made were in view of planned future compliance. But ESCOM, for instance, their compliance roadmap makes abundantly clear that for the majority of their stations, they're never going to comply with the MES, nor do they intend to do so. If we look at sulfur dioxide, the only station that will definitely retrofit flue gas desulfurization, which is to abate sulfur dioxide, is Medupi. And this commitment actually comes from the World Bank loan conditions rather than the need to comply with the MES. It now looks like that retrofit is going to be delayed until 2023. Kusile has FGD installed into its design, and that's the only one of the other 15 coal-fired power stations that is definitely going to comply with the 2020 SO2 MES. There's some discussion and plans about possibly retrofitting Kendall, although not before 2027, and even less likely Matimba, but this is not ESCOM's preferred plan. Groundwork's going to talk tomorrow, and Professor Cairncross will also say a little bit about air quality offsets, but the postponement decisions also then indicated that air quality offsets would be a condition of ESCOM's postponements, apart from at Matimba and Medupi, which are in the Waterberg, as well as SAFL's postponements. What happened then, I've just put in the wording from the NACWA's decision on the slide. More than a year after the postponement decisions, an air quality offset guideline was published, which recommended that offset should be included when MES postponements were granted. So, of course, we agree that the health impacts of domestic fuel burning have to be urgently addressed and that the strategy for addressing air pollution must be fast-tracked. But what we strongly dispute is that offsets can be implemented as an alternative to compliance with the law, quite apart from the fact that these offsets don't actually comply with the principles of offsetting. Instead, they're more like corporate social responsibility projects. This and the other problems with offsets will be elaborated on in Groundwork's presentation tomorrow. So what happened thereafter was that today SAFL will tell us about their offset. after the postponements were granted, the relevant atmospheric emission licenses had to be varied by the licensing authorities to then incorporate these relaxed or postponed emission standards and the air quality offsets. So what is the situation today? And we've heard a bit about it. Almost 3 years later, air pollution remains high in the priority areas. The DEA's draft midterm review of the Highveld Priority Area Air Quality Management Plan confirms that even though it's 10 years since the HPA's declaration, there's little, if any, improvement. Air quality is poor. There's still numerous exceedances of our national ambient air quality standards, although these standards are significantly weaker than the now outdated guidelines of the World Health Organization. Since we submitted our comments, we haven't heard any more from the DEA as to when the midterm review will be finalized or received a copy of the updated midterm review. This dire conclusion about the state of our air also appears from the DEA's 2017 State of the Air report, which was presented at their recent Lekgotla last month, which also says many South Africans may be breathing air that is harmful to their health and well-being, especially in the priority areas. We say that it's clear that the decision of the National Air Quality Officer to grant postponements of compliance with the MES to Eskom and Sasol has a significant negative impact on the prospects of the HPA ever meeting its main goal of reducing air pollution to meet the ambient air quality standards. Because Sasol and Eskom are the largest emitters in the HPA, and in South Africa for that matter, ensuring that they at least both meet the MES should make a meaningful contribution to lowering the excessive ambient air pollution in the area. In any event, NEMA requires us also to minimize emissions, which of course is particularly important in the priority areas. This then was also a conclusion of the October 2017 report entitled Broken Promises, the Failure of South Africa's Priority Areas for Air Pollution. As we presented at the recent Air Quality Colloquium, Broken Promises was the result of the severe frustrations of the CER, the Highveld Environmental Justice Network, and Groundwork regarding the lack of progress in achieving the aim of the HPA. It was our own analysis to determine whether the declaration of the area and the promulgation of the AQMP have actually improved air quality. And as I say, that report also confirms air pollution remains high 10 years after the declaration of the HPA. In fact, the HPA, we say, has dismally failed in its purpose, which was, of course, to improve air quality so that it at least meets the national ambient air quality standards. The impact of that is that residents in the HPA are having their constitutional rights to health and well-being violated. People are dying prematurely and suffering from respiratory and cardiac illnesses that inhibit their prosperity and well-being. This is also going to be elaborated on in Groundwork's presentation tomorrow. Broken Promises set out various demands, which we say are the minimum that are required for the DEA to meet its constitutional obligations under Section 24, that of course is the environmental right, and for authorities to meet their obligations under the AQUA. Although the report focused on the HPA, the demands apply more broadly to the other areas. So here, and specifically in relation to the widespread ongoing non-compliance with the ambient air quality standards, we say immediate steps must be taken to reduce the emissions of pollutants. For instance, all facilities in the HPA should be required to comply at least with the MES. And there we recommend that the NACWA use her powers under AQUA to consider withdrawing the postponements of compliance. Paragraph 14 of the list of activities says that she may do so with review and withdraw any postponement, A, should ambient air quality conditions in the affected area of the plant not conform to ambient air quality standards, and I think it's clear that we all agree that that is the case, and B, following representations from the affected plant or community. Secondly, we believe that no further postponements of compliance with MES or any other license variations that permit exceedances of license emission standards should be allowed. In fact, licensing authorities should suspend the issuing of all new AALs in the HPA, at least until there's consistent compliance with the national ambient air quality standards. That means also that any expansion plans of existing industries should be contingent on a simultaneous substantial reduction in emissions. When facilities reach their scheduled end of life, now I'm thinking particularly of Eskom's coal-fired power stations, AEL should be withdrawn and decommissioning and rehabilitation enforced. And lastly, we recommended that the National Dust Control Regulations be amended to ensure adequate monitoring, measurements, and the reduction of the very significant dust emissions in the HPA. Those are particularly from mining sources. So these demands were made, and the DEA promised a response by the 11th of October, but to date we've had no response forthcoming. What makes this non-compliance with the ambient air quality standards worse is that both Eskom and Sasol have subsequently applied, as we've heard, for further MES postponements, although all of the operations are in priority areas which are already out of compliance with the ambient air quality standards. So since the original postponement application, Sasol's applied for various additional MES postponements at its Sasolburg, Secunda, and Natref operations, at least one of which has already been granted. And it's got another lot of pending applications in 2017. Those outcomes are awaited in relation to its Sasolburg, Secunda, and Natref operations. And Eskom has already reapplied for postponements of the 2015 SO2 MES for Medupi and Matimba. That's despite the fact that those MES have already been in operation for more than 2.5 years, and despite the fact that the NACO has already refused that application in early 2015. The outcome of that reapplication, we understand, has also not yet been received. Eskom's Air Quality Improvement Plan states that it will apply for postponements in 2018-19 and in 2023-24. Eskom here takes the view that its further postponements will be successful if they are, quote, aligned with the retrofit plan committed to government. They identify as what they call a key assumption of the environmental management strategy that MES postponements are going to be granted. As things stand, Eskom only intends to be 57% MES compliant by 2025, and they say full compliance will cost more than $300 billion. But Eskom's identified significant financial savings on the required emission reduction costs by using different technology options, with the revised compliance cost being apparently $107 billion of the capital cost and $1.8 billion OPEX. But this new plan does not meet all of Eskom's original commitments, and they say they are proactively engaging with authorities on the retrofits to address the risk of further postponements not being granted. They intend to, what they call, negotiate with authorities on changes in air quality technology and delayed implementation. In addition, Eskom's been explicit in its intentions to apply for rolling postponements. Reapplying for postponements, and this applies especially for the 2020 MES for SO2, until its stations are eventually decommissioned. So we and our clients and partners have consistently pointed out that these rolling postponements are illegal and would effectively amount to exemptions for which provision is not legally made. Responses to requests for documents from Eskom take many months and are regularly refused, either to the complete record or portions of the document. For instance, Eskom's partially refused access to our request for documents regarding the timing and costs of their planned retrofits. Although in the absence of detailed, credible estimates of costs, it's difficult for us to confirm the accuracy of the costs of compliance at Eskom sites. We do understand the reluctance to spend vast sums of money retrofitting stations that will be decommissioned in the near future. But it is extremely difficult to ascertain what Eskom's true plans are in relation to the lifespans of its coal-fired power stations. In the past, it's indicated it will extend the lives of its stations, but on other occasions said it may decommission a few stations early. Eskom's current air quality improvement plan assumes a 60-year life for its stations, but these actually have a 50-year design lifespan. And the Department of Energy's Integrated Resource Plan for Electricity also assumes 50-year lives. ESCOM's 2017 integrated report says there's been no decision on the possible decommissioning of stations, and ESCOM has no decommissioning plans or funding for the environmental impact assessments that would be required for such decommissioning. Feasibility studies are apparently underway to reassess the lifespan of stations to inform the available options, which would include cold reserve, lean preservation, mothballing, or decommissioning of stations. We were, however, refused access to key components of the life extension feasibility study and refused access to the whole socioeconomic impact assessment for early closure of ESCOM stations. In its integrated report, ESCOM says that Hendrina, Grootvlei, and Komati will be ramped down to zero production and placed in lean preservation to minimize surplus capacity and optimally manage generation costs. Hendrina in 2018-19, Grootvlei in 19-20, and Komati in 2020-2021. Units at Grootvlei and Komati have been placed in extended cold reserve, which means they've been taken offline and can be called back within 5 days. ESCOM also points out the updated integrated resource plan, which we understand is imminent, we're expecting it in the next couple of weeks, will play a major role in determining the future of its coal-fired power stations. On that note, and quite apart from the multiple other benefits of renewable energy over coal, for human health, for water, for land, and the climate, CSIR research shows that the share of renewable energy in the electricity mix that would also be the least cost for South Africa could grow to above 90% by 2050. What's more, research by Meridian Economics, which was presented last Monday at the NERSA hearings on ESCOM's tariff, reveals that it's possible to decommission Grootvlei, Hendrina, and Komati and avoid the completion of Kusile Units 5 and 6, giving rise to a financial saving of about $17 billion. For those stations, the study determined that it was cheaper to provide the services from other resources. This is research that's going to be finalized in the next few weeks. It's also clear, as Prof. Cairncross is going to explain, from our own analysis of ESCOM's compliance with the AELs, that's for the period April 2015 for a year, that they're not even meeting their relaxed emission standards. After this research was done, we addressed a letter to senior DEA officials and provided them a copy with Professor Cairncross's report, which was also then presented at a meeting with the DEA and licensing authorities and was not disputed, although, as Professor Cairncross will explain, this analysis was hindered by refusals of access to various documents requested. The latest National Environmental Compliance and Enforcement Report, which has just been launched, together with the DEA's presentation of today, shows that there's been air quality non-compliance at least 6 ESCOM coal-fired power stations and 2 of SASL sites. So it doesn't appear that such enforcement action as has been taken against ESCOM has led to any meaningful air quality improvement. On the contrary, ESCOM seems confident that it will be granted additional postponement applications. So in its environmental management strategy, ESCOM says, whilst it is making progress towards the objective of achieving full compliance, the journey is not complete. But with all due respect, legal compliance is not a journey. It's a destination that ESCOM should have arrived at years ago. In conclusion, although the provision for MES postponements was apparently intended to provide industries with an opportunity to come into compliance with the MES within, at most, a 5-year period, in practice, it appears that this provision has been abused. This is also recognized by the DEA, as we can see from presentations made at the Air Quality Lekgotla, in which the DEA commented, "In our view, the shortcomings highlighted above have resulted in the abuse of the provisions and, by extension, undermined Section 24 of the Constitution as well as the objectives of the Air Quality Act." It actually proposed possible amendments to the process to clarify that all postponements were granted as a once-off and or to provide for legal consequences for non-compliance with emission standards during the period of the postponement. The DEA has also recognized that compliance with emission standards is generally low, it reported that only 5 of 21 facilities inspected were proactively fully compliant. Eskom and Sasol, as the country's two biggest polluters, have already applied for additional postponements of MES compliance and intend to continue to make further applications, despite being located in the priority areas in which air pollution levels negatively impact human health and the constitutional environmental right. Eskom is not even complying with its relaxed emission standards, and there is no clear plan as to when it will close down its non-compliant stations. To limit further violations of the constitutional rights, the DEA should take the steps identified in Broken Promises, starting with undertakings to review the existing postponements and not to grant further postponements in the priority areas. I'll hand over now to the Prof. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Chairperson and members present. I'm going to speak particularly about Eskom's compliance history since 1st April 2015. But if I may, just in view of the earlier discussion, I'm not sure if you can see this graph, but it is Stats SA data on the number of households using different fuels for cooking. And in view of the different numbers that were bandied around earlier in earlier discussion as to how many people are affected by domestic fuel burning, by coal burning, wood burning, and paraffin, I thought we do have a source of that information. And that information is available down to provincial level and even down to census, a much more local area. So we know how many people are exposed to these fuels and where they are, where they're living. And so when we speak about the balance of sources being responsible for air quality in different areas, we should look at where these areas are and where they are in relation to the domestic fuel sources and industrial sources. And that's just the point that I'd like to make and leave members with that thought that to speak generally doesn't really take the debate further because we need to speak with specific facts in mind. So if I can carry on to my presentation. Well, we know where the priority areas are, but I just want to make one point that the Vaal Triangle and the Eifel priority areas are actually next to each other. So one should look at it as a single area in terms of air quality and the sources of air quality and the impacts of air quality, of poor air quality and emissions. And just to zoom in a bit, on those two priority areas, you'll see that the Eskom coal-fired power stations are 12 of them are located there. Sorry. Oh, it hasn't. Sorry, it hasn't updated. I'm sorry.
I think there's the, let's go back to the previous slides.
Okay.
think it can work.
Chair, if I may, just to that question you asked earlier about the period for which postponements were granted, I think perhaps the question relates to the fact that there's some postponements already to 2025. So what happened when various of the applicants applied is they also applied in 2013 to postpone 2020 standards. So that's why some postponements are until 2025.
Tuli says there is no decision on that. It's up to 2020. Am I correct?
I said they, for some of the stations, it's up to 2025, but they are not more than 5 years because they start in 2020 to 2025.
So...
The application was for the new plant standards, which start in 2020. So the decision is to give them a postponement between 2020 and 2025, which cannot exceed 5 years. So the decision itself is a 5-year decision between 2020 and 2025.
I didn't understand that. I thought all the applications are up to 2020. So which ones are from 2020 to 2025?
Matimba and Kendall for SO2. For PM10, we took a decision not to grant any postponement for PM because the standards were becoming stricter in 2016. So we could go back to look at where we are. But for the SO2 standard, it's not changing. So it's Matimba and Kendall.
Okay, only those two. Okay. So they were supposed to comply with the new plant standard by 2020. So they applied to get that postponement from 2020 to 2025. Are you ready now?
sorry, so I want to go to the point of what a facility needs to do in order to apply for a postponement. And one of the things, as mentioned earlier, is that it has to produce an atmospheric impact report, or AIR, which has a certain scope. Certain things have to be included in that AIR. ESCOM's applications did not, for example, include health impact assessments, but even more seriously, in estimating, you know, what is the impact of a station, what is the contribution to the ambient concentrations of the various pollutants. The modeling used in each impact assessment atmospheric impact report assumed that each of ESCOM's stations was operating in isolation, that the others didn't exist and didn't contribute to pollution in that particular area. That's why I made reference to the fact that they clustered in the Vaal Triangle and the High Fault Priority Area. In those two areas, you have 12 of the 14 stations, and they all contribute together collectively to ambient air pollution. But in the modeling presented as part of the applications, they pretended that all the others didn't exist, and only one, you only look at one station at a time, and you're not adding the pollution. So that is the second deficiency. The third one was that a basic method of using air pollution modeling is to compare your results with your measurements to see if the modeling is giving you realistic answers. Otherwise, you can't draw conclusions from that modeling. ESCOM did not do this, or did that in only three of the 13 stations at that stage could only compare the modeling defective as it was with measured values at three of the stations. So it therefore, first of all, in those instances, the modeled values, the calculated values were between underestimated concentrations by between 60 and 80%. So they did a set of calculations, showed that the calculations when you compare with the measured values was between 60 and 80% too low. But yet they used the results of those calculations to say whether or not the stations were having a significant impact. And also for all of their power stations. So in a number of important respects, the picture they presented of the atmospheric impact of their stations was not valid. In spite of all that, while admitting that the measured values showed widespread non-compliance with the in the priority areas, ESCOM introduced the argument that it's not us; their emissions are not responsible for the non-compliance, particularly not responsible for the non-compliance with respect to the particulate matter, the PM10 and PM2.5 standards. It also denied that SO2 and NOx emissions contribute to PM2.5 formation and therefore additionally contribute to high ambient PM particulate matter levels. So firstly, they're saying that the measured values they admit show that there's non-compliance, but that they go on to say, but we are not responsible for that. It's other sources, and invariably they point to domestic fuel burning as a source of those PM emissions. In other words, they are. So we responded with extensive arguments pointing out these deficiencies, but the National Air Quality Office nonetheless granted substantially all requested postponements. And in addition, ESCOM's emission reduction plans indicated that on certain power stations it had no intention of ever complying with the MES. And the following table shows the licenses issued as per the Air Quality Office's, National Air Quality Office's decisions. And the color-coded stations all were given licenses which did not comply with the MES. In other words, the emission values allowed were above the values set forth in the MES for existing plants. So they were given leniency for existing plant standards as from 31st of March or 1st of April 2015. The summary is there. 8 of the 14 stations would not meet the, or were issued licenses which did not meet the minimum emission standards for existing plants. The next question is, does ESCOM in the period 31st or the 1st of April 2015 to date, does ESCOM comply with the relaxed limits given in the atmospheric emission licenses? And it was not easy for me to establish this. Each station must report their compliance record for a given year in an annual report. But that report does not actually report compliance. It gives you monthly averages, and monthly averages are not regulated. It is daily averages which are regulated. So they don't actually report the daily average values for the year. So I had to do a complicated exercise to estimate what their daily average concentrations were. And the basis of this was, if the average for the month already exceeds what the daily average is, then they must have been non-compliant for at least half the days in that month. If it is close to the daily average, then it's likely that at least some days in the month, and so on. So I had to do all these calculations and concluded that 7 of the 12 stations for which I had data were either very likely not compliant or likely not compliant with their particulate values, and 2 stations were probably not compliant with their NOx emission values. So, in summary, they were granted relaxed emission limits in their licenses, and even with respect to these relaxed emission limit values, they were not complying, at least in the first year after these regulations came into force or the licenses were issued. Subsequently, Madupi, as Robin has mentioned, and Matimba applied for further relaxation of their SO2 emission limit. In other words, even above the value that they were given initially. And this implies that both Madupi and Matimba are also not in compliance with all of their license conditions. In other words, all 14 stations are probably not consistently compliant with existing plant emission limit values. Now, there was much discussion about the Madupi and Matimba particularly wanting to relax the SO2 limit values because of high sulfur in coal and the cost and the difficulty of complying with the emission limit values. Now, a condition of the loans used to finance Madupi included loans from the African Development Bank and the World Bank. And a condition of that loan, or that portion of the loan, was that they install flue gas desulfurization, and 6 years after each unit is complete. But it also involved these financial institutions in an ongoing monitoring process to see if the conditions that they had included in their loan were being met. And in the most recent visit, earlier this year, the mission made the following observations. the purpose was to review the implementation of the Eskom Madupi Power Project and Eskom Investment Support Project, and reported the following with respect to Madupi's SO2 emissions. The next bullet point. The mission expressed concern, and I'm quoting from the report, that Eskom expects that Madupi will not be able to comply with the existing plant standard of 3,500 milligrams per normal meter cubed. Future seams of coal from Exxaro mine are likely to have sulfur content higher than 1.7%, which will result in possible exceedances of SO2 emissions. Eskom informed the mission that blending of coal in the interim would help realize desired emission levels that would meet the standard. However, this measure cannot be implemented until the end of 2017, when the coal reclaimer and so on would be available. The mission again suggested, implying that they had previously made this suggestion, again suggested that ESCOM seriously consider an interim strategy to control SO2 emissions for the next 6 years before the scrubbers or the flue gas desulfurization becomes operational. And that includes the consideration to adopt a direct furnace limestone injection program, which has been tested in the USA and Europe and shown to reduce SO2 emissions by up to 50%. In summary, there were two methods of controlling the SO2 emissions or reducing the SO2 emissions which were available to them, which did not require the full time and money for the flue gas desulfurization, but ESCOM appeared not to be willing to embark on these. Now, I just want to point out that if we have access to monthly reports which show day-to-day compliance with the MES or non-compliance with the MES, it would be quite easy to establish whether or not a plant and a unit on a plant is compliant. And here are a couple of copies or examples of these monthly reports. This one is for Kendall, and you can see, I'm not sure if the arrow will show up, but you can see 3 days during which emissions were well above the red line, the emission limit value. And here's another month, 2 occasions, and this is for a different plant. This is for, I think it's Duva. And there are 3 days which the plant was not compliant, and so on. a different month, December 2016. And this one is in relation to, this is the only annual report that I have which shows on a day-to-day basis whether or not the plant is complying with its emission limit value. In this case, the value is 350 instead of 100. So it's an extremely lax license condition. But even in this case, there were several days on which the plant did not comply with that 350 limit. Now to Sasol. Now, as mentioned earlier, the Sasol situation is extremely complicated. The ESCOM coal-fired power station is relatively simple because they're all more or less the same regulated pollutants and so on. But with Sasol, they have a large number of different processes. So I've just given you the summary that was done after the postponement decisions was made, to give you a verbal impression. Now, if I had drawn this graphic, I would have swapped the colors, because the green means that the postponement applications were granted, and the red means they were refused. It should have been the other way around. You know, in other words, substantially all of Sasol's postponement applications were granted. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Hey, the picture you are painting is quite scary. Huh? For me, I don't know for the members. I mean, does it really have to take the donors to get a utility in the country to comply with South African legislation? I can imagine if there were, if that condition was not there for Medupi and for other stations. Was it Medupi only?
Smadupi only because of the loan conditions.
I'm saying if that loan condition was not there, I wonder if compliance was going to be, Eskom was going to comply. But Eskom is here. Is Eskom here? Yeah. You're listening, I'm sure. At an appropriate time, you'll have to respond to all these this issues that are arising from Center for Environmental Rights.
Chair, we will respond tomorrow when we present.
Yeah. Okay, let me just get the questions. I've got too many. I don't know where to start, but maybe I must allow the members. Any question? Dr. Luyang. Maybe we must adjourn now and give our guests some time to